Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here with you today. I'm thrilled to introduce our panel, What Makes Life Worth Meaning, Powerful Stories of Love and Loss. And I admire you for venturing in here on a Saturday morning to talk about the big picture and what really matters. I am your moderator today because I have something in common with our guests. I experienced loss at a young age and later went on to write about it. I'm going to tell a very brief story from that time just to introduce our conversation. So I was 30 years old and my husband had died 9 months earlier from cystic fibrosis. And needless to say, many of life's details had slipped through the wayside. I no longer had car insurance because I just couldn't remember to make the payments. So I went down to AAA right here in Berkeley and sat across from Lou Montgomery, who was an insurance agent. And I had to take my husband's name off the policy, so I told him about my husband's death, also hoping a little bit that it would excuse my flakiness in the widow card. And I said, he asked me, well, how long ago was that? You know, and I said, well, he died in March. It's been 9 months. And I thought, you know, that probably sounds like a little bit of a long time to not pay your car insurance. And he looked at me, and then he nodded toward a picture on the wall of a young man about 25 and his wife and kids, and he said, my son died in April. And the world just fell away. We were huddled in this little cubicle in AAA, and around us, you know, everyone's arguing about car insurance, and we were talking to each other about things that we'd never voiced to anyone. He said to me, well, do you still talk to your husband? I said, yeah. And he said, out loud? And I said, yeah. and then we agreed that it was mainly best to do this in the car while you're driving. We talked about work suddenly being this glorious 9-hour vacation from what was really going on. We talked about guilt and we talked about family. I asked him, you know, do you think I really have to go on the date with the dog trainer because I don't want to, but sometime you got to go on a first date? And he was like, nah, you don't need to do that. And he asked me, well, you know, should I be with my family on Christmas morning because I feel like I'm going to be just really dragging everybody else down? And I said, yeah, you should be with your family. And so we left this conversation feeling, I can't describe the words for it, lighter, better, relieved. And we just desperately needed to have it, but those kind of conversations are so hard to come by. And it's interesting to me, you know, grief is universal and profound and life-changing and actually really interesting, but it also is a real showstopper at a dinner party, you know, of course, okay, but even at work and even with your closest friends and family. And I'm so pleased today because we have three guests who are going to be talking about their writing and works that are really helping to change this. I want to say I'm so grateful for the Society for Art and Cultural Heritage of India for having us here today. We really are blessed to be here and we promise to do our best for all of you. I'm really pleased to introduce Dr. Lucy Kalanithi, whose late husband, Paul Kalanithi, Dr. Paul Kalanithi, wrote the stunning bestseller memoir, When Breath Becomes Air. Paul was a neurosurgeon who, upon learning he was dying of cancer, set out to write about facing mortality, admirable in itself. About Paul's book, Dr. Atul Gawande wrote, rattling, heartbreaking, and ultimately beautiful, the too young Dr. Kalanithi's memoir is proof that the dying are the ones who have the most to teach us about life. Lucy saw Paul's book to completion and wrote its eloquent epilogue. She has also written essays for the New York Times and Modern Loss. She is an internal medicine physician and faculty member at the Stanford School of Medicine. So welcome, Lucy. Rebecca Purser on our far left is Rebecca Sofer. Thank you, is a former producer for the Colbert Report and the co-founder of the Modern Loss website, which offers original essays, resources, and community, and which the New York Times has hailed as redefining mourning. She is also the co-author of Modern Loss, a book inspired by the website, which gathers fresh, thought-provoking perspectives on grief. StoryCorps founder Dave Isay describes Modern Loss as a book about grieving and death that shimmers with life, in turn raw, searing, witty, and funny. It's full of surprises and definitely not your mother's death and dying book. More on that later. Elizabeth Purser, in the middle here, is the author of two novels, All Stories Are Love Stories, and An Uncommon Education, and of Ultrasound, a book of poems on the intersection of medicine and pregnancy. She is a three-time nominee for the Pushcart Prize and has twice been honored by the Dorothy Sargent Rosenberg Foundation. She's a contributor to Modern Loss, in which she writes about loss, love, and motherhood with incisive grace. So we are going to begin by hearing the stories of these two books. We'll start with Dr. Paul Kalanithi. Say it one more time for me. Dr. Paul Kalanithi's book, When Breath Becomes Air. Lucy's going to tell us a little bit about it and read from it.
Thanks for having me here today. So When Breath Becomes Air came out a little over 2 years ago, and Paul died a little over 3 years ago. And he was a neurosurgeon at Stanford who was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer when he was 36. And he died 22 months later, initially returning to work as a physician, and then very fortuitously, almost accidentally getting an essay in the New York Times called How Long Have I Got Left, that was about uncertainty and mortality and prognostication in medicine. And he'd written it as like a kind of a journal processing and essay and sent it to two friends, one of whom wrote back and said, this essay's not that great and you buried the lead and it's not funny like you are and you kind of say four different things. And the other one who wrote back and said, I forwarded this to the New York Times, I hope that's okay. And thank goodness, because Paul had been a longtime lover of literature who surprised himself by going into medicine, had always thought he would be an English professor perhaps, and had this distant dream of maybe being a writer after a career in neurosurgery. And then this sort of came to be his contribution to medicine and thinking about meaning and mortality in a way that he had done as a thinker and then as a physician and then back to being a writer. So, you know, and watching Paul write the manuscript for this really taught me something, especially as a physician, about how, you know, disability or illness and aging change our identities so much, and maintaining a purpose and maintaining an identity, even if it's a new one, through that kind of hardship is very fortifying. I think it was Nietzsche who said, he who has a why to live can bear almost any how. And it's like Maslow's hierarchy turned over on its head, you know? It's like you can have your life crumble around you, and as long as you feel connected and purposeful, it will get you a long way. And it was really interesting to see during Paul's illness. And then for me, after Paul died, he had sold the book to Random House and was like sort of mostly finished with a draft manuscript, but working with the editor to approve the copy edits and choose the cover and shape it just a little bit with some other essays that Paul had written to make sure it was long enough, turned out to be for me just an incredible tool during grief to feel connected to Paul and like I was still, you know, like looking out for Paul and participating in a thing with Paul that was very meaningful and great. And we had a daughter during that time too when Paul was sick. So I'll read a tiny piece about, in Paul's words, about the experience of being ill and then the decision to have this child. And a thing he said to me that I found so illuminating that I've also called on since then. Let me just find this one. Sorry, I lost the page. Okay. Once I'd been diagnosed with a terminal illness, I began to view the world through two perspectives. I was starting to see death as both doctor and patient. As a doctor, I knew not to declare, cancer is a battle, I'm going to win. Or ask, why me? Answer, why not me? While being trained as a physician and scientist had helped me process the data and accept the limits of what that data could reveal about my prognosis, it didn't help me as a patient. It didn't tell me whether to fight for my career, to reclaim the ambitions I had single-mindedly pursued for so long, but without the surety of the time to complete them. Flush in the face of mortality, many decisions became compressed, urgent, and unreceding. Foremost among them for us, should Lucy and I have a child? Even if our marriage had been strained toward the end of my residency, we'd always remained very much in love. Our relationship was still deep in meaning, a shared and evolving vocabulary about what mattered. Having children had been something we'd always wanted, and we were both impelled by the instinct to do it still, to add another chair to our family's table. Both of us yearning to be parents, we each thought of the other. Lucy hoped I had years left, but understanding my prognosis, she felt that the choice, whether to spend my remaining time as a father, should be mine. "What are you most afraid of or sad about?" she asked me one night as we were lying in bed. "Leaving you," I told her. "Will having a newborn distract from the time we have together?" she asked. "Don't you think saying goodbye to your child will make your death more painful?" "Wouldn't it be great if it did?" I said. That's my favorite part. Lucy and I both felt that life wasn't about avoiding suffering. Years ago, it had occurred to me that Darwin and Nietzsche agreed on one thing. The defining characteristic of the organism is striving. Describing life otherwise was like painting a tiger without stripes. We talked it over. Our families gave their blessing. We decided to have a child. We would carry on living instead of dying.
Thank you, Lucy.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, I think all of you have faced mortality as a young person, and it is really, it's really moving to hear this idea that that suffering is included in life, and that's part of it, and we're going to move forward. And I'm wondering what you each think about what it's been particularly like to face it while you're young. You're all looking at me. Okay, so I'll go first. So I wasn't necessarily a kid when I lost both my parents, but by the time I was 33, I had lost both of them, and I think it's safe to say that when that happens to you, you sure as hell feel like a kid. My mom died in a car accident when I was 30. I was single. I was living in New York. I was working in daily television. It was not my life plan to lose my mom very suddenly, about 45 minutes after I said goodbye to her, but I did. And my dad died from a heart attack 3 years later. And again, not part of my, I'm a parent, I like parents, you know, like I like hanging out with parents, I like Mother's Day, like I like, you know, snuggling up to other people's mothers. It's like weird, but I really enjoy it. And so all of a sudden, the foundation of my life was really ripped out from under my feet. I'm an only child between my mom and my dad. And I was feeling very untethered from everything I had known beforehand. I mean, really nothing made sense to me at all. I didn't recognize any part of my world anymore. And I kept repeating, I'm an orphan. Like, and it sounded so weird and so self-indulgent to call myself an orphan at 33. But I felt like I was like eight, you know? I felt like I was clutching a dented tin pail, begging for gruel in the alley, you know, in Dickensian times, because that's how isolated and alone I felt. And I think that, you know, so I do define that as a young age, because it was also at a time in my life where everybody else surrounding me, like, let's be honest, 30 is like the new 21, right? So, and especially in New York City, like, 30 is like the new 7, because you're renting an apartment you can't afford, and you're, like, doing Ollie's takeout every day, and, you know, you're just living like a child, because, you know, especially if you choose to work in TV, you have, like, no money. And so everybody around me was also my age, and they were focused on building up their lives. They were focused on finding that partner, as, you know, you've written about that, finding that partner, getting the dog, getting the mortgage, you know, getting the career advancement. And I was focused on all of that too. But at the same time, I was focused, like, it was like this, such a stark contrast between losing and gaining. And I had to navigate that every second of every day. And to boot, I had to pitch comedy jokes for a living. I was a producer for the Colbert Report. So 2 weeks after my mom died, I got to go in and start making fun of politicians again, which, you know, is obviously God's work, but it's not, you know, it wasn't always easy to do. So I think that, you know, for me, my experience was not losing a spouse, but losing the foundation as an only child. Like, my parents They really were my best friends. And so my experience losing at that age really did teach me about the fragility of life. I did not lose either one of my parents to a long illness. I lost them from 1 second to the next. I said goodbye to my mom. I gave her a really deep hug, and I said, I love you, and I was supposed to see her 5 days later at my cousin's wedding in Philly. And I got a phone call 45 minutes later that there was a terrible accident on the turnpike in New Jersey, which is a super insulting place to lose your life. And she did, you know? And so it really did enable me. I mean, Lucy just wrote that passage, honestly slays me every single time I hear it. I just want to break down because it's so, you know, Paul, like, I'll just read things. I'll be like, oh, Paul. I'm like, I want to, like, talk to him. And, you know, I can, but he doesn't answer. But it's so true. Like, wouldn't it be great if it made it more painful to say goodbye as you amass all these beautiful things in life? And I think for me, my experience was it really emboldened me to take more risks than I might have ordinarily taken at the age that I was, when I was supposed to be, yeah, taking risks, but also being, like, really responsible about my path, my career. Like, what are my plans? What is, like, my 401k? You know, what's the deal? And instead, I really just not only had to parent myself, but I also had to, like, toe the line between being responsible and also really being emboldened. Mm-hmm. And I think normally I'm kind of a carpe diem type of person, but losing them very suddenly made me realize that, you know, the mañana attitude, it doesn't serve you very well. You just have to go for it. And that might sound really cliche, but cliches are cliche for a reason.
Mm-hmm. What about?
So I didn't really lose somebody when I was young. One of my best friends, Rhina, was 49 when she died of an aneurysm. And she had been sort of my soul sister as a mother. Our kids were the same age, and we'd shared a fence for 7 years. So we sort of, our families had really bled into each other. But one of the things that I love about what Rebecca and Gabby did with the Modern Loss book is they really explored loss from all angles, and they open with a section called collateral damage, which I just adore, because, you know, if you lose somebody who's an immediate relative, the parameters are somehow easier to understand. But for many of us, grief can be a scattershot experience depending on how close you are to the loved ones. And I had lost people very close to me, but somehow Raina's death, because she had been listed as the guardian for our children should we die, there's something about seeing children lose their mother, children who were as close to my heart as any children who are not my own could be, was really just a hugely shocking experience that I was in no way prepared for. So I think watching children go through grief and loss, and not being the Jewish mother that I am and jump in and, like, try to fix it 8 ways from Sunday, but to actually let children experience this incredible wave of dark emotion was, I think, perhaps the most challenging thing of just being near and around that experience.
Well, could you read from your piece?
Sure. So, let me see. I'm still deciding what I want to read.
Oh.
Sure. So, I think I've set it up well enough to just dive in. This is a pretty short essay, so I'm just essentially reading you the second half. Almost immediately, a powerful circle of support collected around the family, a hive of friends and neighbors and teachers and classmates, with her 2 children at its dark, protected core. But for the most part, all we could do was wring our hands as the kids walked around, emptied from the inside out, their bodies self-consciously awkward, as if they'd lost their sense of how to move through the world, perhaps their very sense of the world itself. And everything in me wanted to sweep in and absorb them into whatever kind of mothering nest I could fashion, to take these children I loved almost as much as my own and show them that there was a mother nearby, willing to do whatever she could to stem the tide of their grief. But I loved them well enough to know that this would have been a selfish act, a way that they could resist the deep pain that came with the awareness that Rhina was gone. This was something I'd help them to see as a friend could, rather than something I might protect them from as a mother might. So when Conrad, who usually waited until after school to eat most of his lunch, settling happily on his mother's lap with both legs around her waist while she took inventory of his day and leftovers, ran into his dad's arms when the bell rang, I forced myself to only mention the lunchbox before walking away. And when Sophia got her ears pierced, I held back my tears of grief and pride and offered her my hand to squeeze as tightly as she wanted if it helped with the pain. And although I thought I'd have to go to therapy over the fact that their dad was not putting them in therapy, I still might, I made sure to meet them wherever they were when they wanted to talk about their mom, even if it was only to reflect on her great cooking or the abundance of curious things now flourishing in her garden. A few months after Rina's death, Conrad contracted pneumonia and Stevens-Johnson syndrome, a life-threatening disorder that causes a blistering rash over the entire body. Perhaps it was a run of extraordinary bad luck, perhaps the result of a physical and emotional depletion that few young children could withstand. Visiting him in the hospital before any of us knew whether he was out of the woods, I stood at the foot of his bed, watching as his father and a team of nurses struggled like gentle marionettes to combat his almost feral, half-conscious refusal to take his medication. I have never battled more painfully with my maternal instincts, which in this case were to take him into my arms, kiss him, hold him down like a mother lion would her cub, and tell the professionals to get their goddamn jobs done and get out of there. To do what Rina would have done, what she would have wanted to do for any one of my children. Instead, I stayed at the foot of his bed and silently cheered him on as he growled and whined, my head resting lightly on his ankle, the bedsheet between us, the thinnest barrier between his wild thrashing and the surety I was silently communicating to him that he was loved beyond measure, beyond the limits of grief and fear. And as painful as it was not to mother when the ache from mothering was so palpable, I found a different sort of rightness in how I was with him just then, a new awareness of how love can flood beyond the definitions we have for it. Usually, when we reflect on how love doesn't play by the rules, we are referring to its poor timing, or its unrequited victims, or its failure to sustain anything beyond the rush of infatuation. But maybe when rules falter or even collapse, we aren't just left in a free fall. We are also in the presence of unusual windows of opportunity. The modern world doesn't allow many of us to raise our children as I think we should, in clusters and groups, so that while love is abundant, the sense that one person is indispensable is not as powerful as the sense that others will always be there. Because just as death can come in unexpected and life-changing ways, so too can care. There is, after all, no reason why a person cannot be both a mother and a mother figure, why we can't both fully grieve a mother and still continue to be fueled by what she showed us all how to do so well, to weather suffering and emerge with the joy of being even more connected after the worst has passed. And that little last line is an allusion to the fact that Rina actually lived through the Bosnian War. So, and she was one of the most joyful, easygoing people I'd ever met. So that really was a big part of the inspiration behind what she created for all of us.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm wondering if other people have thoughts about unexpected opportunities that come up from loss. Not at all to paint a sunny picture on it, but just like you were saying, that I think there are these unexpected windows of opportunity.
Yeah. I agree with that. I've sort of came into this somewhat as a physician, but then certainly through having this loss myself, feeling a real communion through suffering that I think has sort of deepened my relationships and experience of the world too. I was sharing this with Rebecca last night. She stayed at my house, but I, after Paul's book came out, got a number of letters that were so nice to get, and it'll make me write to authors in the future, actually. And One of them was somebody in on the Isle of Skye whose wife had died, who sent this CD of beautiful traditional music that he had used as part of a fundraiser for liver cancer. And this, he wrote me this letter about having been in a similar experience and said, you know, track number 4 is the song to which my wife walked down the aisle at our wedding. And for, you know, about 18 months after Paul died, I felt so profoundly lonely. And at one point was sitting in our condo listening to this music and thinking, like, how beautiful is this, that this family I will never meet, certainly this woman I will never meet who's died, like, I'm immersed in their wedding music and thinking about my own wedding and thinking about love and loss. And then Rebecca and I listened to it last night. It was sort of like, I would never know. Rebecca would never be on this panel. I'd never have a whole host of experiences that have been really illuminating and beautiful and connecting. That's sort of the most important part. So I think, I don't know what the point of suffering is, but I certainly feel as if it is a real opportunity to connect with other people forever. And it's so crazy how painful grief is. You know, it's like we think about how, you know, mortality is present and true and universal, but so is grief, like you said, Liz. And it's just like, it's so immense. You know, I remember thinking, I cannot believe this is a thing that everybody does. If you're lucky, you know, like to love somebody this much and then lose them and do this. And I think, you know, grief and love are real inverses of each other in depth and in some ways in form. And I think that's the other thing that became illuminated to me about grief is the durability of love and relationship even when somebody's gone. And I wanted to read a tiny piece from an essay that I wrote that's about that idea. And this came out soon after Paul's book was published. One night recently, alone in bed, I read A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis, and I came across the observation that, quote, bereavement is not the truncation of married love, but one of its regular phases. He writes that what we want is to live our marriage well and faithfully through that phase too. Yes, I breathed. Bereavement is more than learning to separate from a spouse. Though I can no longer comfort Paul, the other vows I made on our wedding day, to love Paul, to honor and keep him, stretch well beyond death. Before he died, Paul asked me to shepherd the manuscript of his book to publication. Doing so, I have felt I'm continuing to help Paul live out his life and give this gift to our daughter. And now, as I prepare to watch Paul's book work take on a life of its own, I begin to take on a life of my own. Our home is now a home for our daughter and me. I've kept Paul's favorite clothes and books, but he no longer has a sock drawer or his own bookcase. I bought a new bed. I've gone back to work. 6 months after Paul died, I removed my wedding ring because it felt right to do so in that moment. Only minutes before, I had not yet considered it. I've learned that the timing of bereavement, perhaps like the initial stages of falling in love, is utterly unpredictable. As a child, I was always told that a grave should be stepped around, not onto, that only flowers should touch it. With Paul, the rules feel reversed. Just as it felt right to lie with him, finally restful on that spring afternoon, a few weeks after his death, this is like I was lying on the ground on top of the grave, it feels right to bring friends there now, to watch the sunset and pour a beer out for him. And it feels right for our bright-eyed one-year-old daughter to crawl among the flowers I've placed on the grave. We are making this place ours and his.
Beautiful. Thank you, Lucy. Thanks. I'm really struck by the idea of grief shifting over time. I know it has for me, and I'd like to hear what you guys are thinking about that.
I mean, I think that, so what I run is called Modern Loss, and...
Yeah, sorry, Rebecca, why don't you tell a little bit about the story of this book so that we refer to it, people know.
So Modern Loss started as a website that we launched 4 years ago when I was quite literally 9.5 months pregnant, so I'm like, clearly not an intelligent person to have chosen to do that. But, you know, since then, and it exists because we're really tired of not only the isolation, but the very overt stigma that still exists surrounding talking about this stuff. And if you look at the stuff that we're talking about on a daily basis in current events, it's really nonsensical that this should be. This should not be a taboo. This should not be a stigma. As Lucy said, she couldn't believe that everybody goes through this. It's such an incredible experience in every single way possible. So why aren't we talking about it? And why are we only talking about it during the first, you know, week or 30 days or year? You know, why is it that on day 366 you're supposed to stop talking about it in a way that's really gut-wrenching and excruciating because people assume that you should be moving on or over? And these are words that I don't like. I like through, because grief is something that you just live through every single day thereafter. It's your companion. It shapes you. It doesn't make you who you are. You're still who you were, but it helps shape you, and it helps you think about what your new priorities might be, and how you want to lead your life, and how you want to commune with all the people around you or not commune with them. And so this site has run several hundred personal essays written by a variety of people. I publish, I curate, I assign, edit, but this is just for a lot of other people. It's not like the Rebecca and Gabby website. And from that came this book, which came out a couple of months ago and which Liza and Lucy have written for, which means that we're like the luckiest people on the planet to have their words. You just heard what amazing writers they are. And the book is astounding, and it came out of seeing all these different topics bubble up to the surface time and again over the last few years that we've been running the site. And the topics aren't like who I lost, how I lost them. It's the themes. It's, as Liza mentioned, collateral damage. But wait, there's more? You know, it doesn't end just with the funeral. Loss is going to visit you in many different ways. It's going to affect your body. It's going to affect how you, you know, communicate with the person closest to you because another person is missing. It's just going to mess with everything. It's going to affect intimacy issues and your identity. And time is going to shape your loss. And so that's how we divided up the book, which are into these overarching themes. And each chapter allowed these writers, including myself, to explore those themes in a really in-depth way. And so when you ask about, you know, our perception of grief over time, I don't define myself as a grieving person. I think we call it modern loss because we are talking about loss, and I think that you can live with loss and not necessarily identify yourself as grieving. And that's just a personal definition for me. I mean, grief is endless permutations and combinations of definitions. I think that I define myself as living with loss, and the loss has these moments of grief that take me by surprise and that don't take me by surprise. And I think that in terms of how it's shaped over time, you know, it visits me in ways that are so unexpected that it could just render me breathless at a moment's notice. And I think that, you know, the times that it most visits me these days are I have very little kids, and I didn't have them when my mom was alive, and I didn't have them when my dad was alive, and they're never going to meet either one of my parents, and my parents aren't going to meet them. And I thought that maybe, you know, the time that the day I gave birth was going to be the most painful experience for me because my mom, my best friend, wasn't going to be around to just be there for me emotionally and tell me how to like change a diaper, because I like literally did not know what I was doing. Do not tell anybody. And now I've told all of you. But, you know, but it wasn't. That wasn't the most painful time. The most painful time was when my oldest son, who's now 4, turned 1. And all of a sudden, he started becoming a human person in the world with traits that reminded me of my mom, or doing things that, oh my God, I just want to tell them about, or taking on, you know, doing things that I wanted to ask them. Did I do this? Like, what? And I just realized, like, this lack of witness to my own life, it hit me so hard, and it continues to hit me hard really every day, whether it's for a second or for hours at a time. And so I think that, you know, grief, this could be like an hours long discussion on how grief takes shape over time, but I would say that in my case, it went from something that really I felt owned me, mm-hmm. to something that I have now, with many years under my belt of being in this role, have learned to own for the most part. And that ownership has come from being very willing, and I guess maybe brave enough, to tell my narrative to people, to define what my narrative is, to tell people about my lost story, to not hide behind it, to not feel like I have to be sanctimonious when I'm talking about, you know, my dead mom or my dead dad, and hushed tones when we all of a sudden switch the topic to death. You know, I think that we all know that it takes a lot more effort to make other people feel comfortable when we're talking about loss than it does to just let it all hang out, because people don't want us to. But in my experience, the moment I did start letting it all hang out and just being open about my story, I just felt I exhaled so deeply, and I haven't looked back since then. So in a nutshell, that's my experience.
You know, so much of what you say resonates with what I feel are some of the lies that we get told about grief, like it will get easier with time. It's a lie. but I think what does happen is actually a lot more miraculous in a sense, because I feel that it doesn't feel like things change with time. It feels more that I'm learning how to integrate the grief into who I am as the years go on, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it diminishes. Just before this panel started, I warned Rebecca, because sometimes I can talk about Raina and I'm just like completely clear-sighted. Other days, like her name, and it's just waterworks, and there's not necessarily any warning, so be prepared. But I think that sense of integrating the grief is really powerful, and in some ways I feel so much more connected to other people, because when people mention grief or in passing or otherwise, I can look them in the eye in a way I couldn't before. I can stand with them in a way I couldn't before, and that actually really makes me feel more comforted, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about you too as a doctor, Lucy, and if that's, if facing mortality and grieving has changed your relationship with your patients or how you see your role?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, certainly internally, I think I haven't really shared. I have some patients who've read Paul's book and then figure out by the last name who I am, but internally, I think it's changed my experience or just made me more comfortable like sitting next to people, like you said. And then grief shifting over time, I think, I think about this with my daughter, where, who was 8 months old after Paul died and won't have any memory of him, but then will grow up into getting to know him. And that's sort of like flipping things on its head. It's not like forgetting Paul, it's the opposite. It's like learning about Paul and developing a relationship with Paul that will grow over time. And maybe she won't be interested in Paul. That might be the more painful thing that could happen. But I think she will, because she already is. And I made her this little book about Paul, having realized, you know, how do I help her sort of, she hears his name and she understands that that's her dad. But I made her a little book that's, you know, she knows all about Peppa Pig and she knows all about Elmo, and she's like very intimately involved in their life details. And I was like, you know, why don't I do that? Why don't I make a book about Paul? So I literally made a book with pictures of him, and he's a kid, and then he grows up in Nana Mantata's house, and then he's the things that he liked to do, and he loved dogs and reading and whatever. And then he becomes a grown up and he's a doctor, and then his body stops working. And that's what you're supposed to say. The child life specialist, the vernacular these days, his body stopped working.
Oh, interesting.
And she's all the time, she'll be like, here's a dead bee. His body stopped working. Well, it's like, what does she think that means? I don't know. And then, and it sounds sort of scary to me, but it doesn't seem scary to her. And then, and it's like, she goes to visit this grave. She has no idea what that is, but she'll grow up into knowing that. And then ultimately she'll read Paul's book, which he conceived as a message to her too. It's sort of like he talks about striving, and he writes one paragraph directly to her. Yeah. And it's like, he's basically saying like, it's important to try hard and I love you. And that's what he basically says. And I think that's what everybody's saying to their children, you know? And so it's gonna be really interesting to see that. I really look forward to that process of going through that. with her. And then she just says interesting things too. You know, the other day we have this little bell in our house that was part of a wedding favor at our wedding. And she had it and it was like, you know what that is? That's actually from my wedding to Daddy, and here's what a wedding is, and then you get to have a big party with everybody you love. And she said, and where was I? Was I at the party?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, you weren't even born yet, actually. And she said, I was dead. And I was just kind of like, oh my God. And it's like, it's just like interesting, you know? And I think that's the thing you were talking about with children in this situation. Like, there's a lot to learn from them too, you know? And yeah, and I just, it changes over time.
Yeah. Do you want to read that last paragraph from Paul?
Oh, sure. Or, yeah, okay. I have to read it.
It's a stunning, I'm asking selfishly because it's a stunning paragraph and it really stayed with me about, it's amazing.
Sure. Yeah. So the last paragraph of the book, I haven't memorized, I didn't even try, but I'll just say it. And Paul's talking about the nature of time toward the end of the book and how he talks about how he used to think about ambition and, you know, this idea of having a long time horizon. And then he said in person, I think not in the book, he said, you know, time used to feel linear and now it feels more like a space. Mm-hmm. And talks about how it's like a flattened ladder and he doesn't think about the future in the same way. And so then the last paragraph mentions time a couple of different ways. And so it's kind of interesting to listen for that. But he writes to our daughter and he says, you know, I don't know what I would say to this child down the line. And I think there's only one thing to say to her, and it's now. And he says, when you come to one of the many moments in life when you must give an account of yourself, provide a ledger of what you have been and done and meant to the world. Do not, I pray, discount that you filled a dying man's days with a sated joy. A joy unknown to me in all my prior years. A joy that does not hunger for more and more, but rests satisfied. In this time, right now, that is an enormous thing.
Thank you. Yeah. That's beautiful. So I'm going to shift things just a little bit. I want to talk about one part of the Modern Loss book, which is my daughter said to me, she's been watching me read these books and asking all kinds of questions. She's 10. And she said, well, why is it called Modern Loss? I mean, loss just doesn't seem very modern. And so,
touche.
Yeah.
Little girl.
I was like, well, come to the panel, my 10-year-old. She didn't want to do that. But I wanted Rebecca to read about some particularities in grieving right now.
Sure.
Modern era.
Well, I want to meet your daughter, first of all. Second of all, I forgot
You'll
my
like
glasses,
yeah.
So this should be interesting. Third, my current baby stole my vision, so this should be really interesting. The modern and modern loss, I mean, I don't think we're just talking about this day and age. I mean, very much so we are. And I think inherently what we do at Modern Loss just kind of naturally draws people in who are experiencing loss a little bit earlier than they might have ordinarily expected to. So a lot of our audience is in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s. We also have, you know, a wide variety of readers. We actually have some contributors to the book who are in their 70s and 80s. But I think for the most part, it's a lot of younger people because it was born out of basically my selfish need to connect with other people's experiences about the mess that is this nonlinear aspect of, or this nonlinear process of loss, but also read stories of resilience. This book is really not, you know, meant to be a downer. It's really actually meant to be quite inspiring because when you are a younger person and you're going through it, you actually really need some sort of proof that life isn't completely over at the ripe old age of whatever you are, 24, 30, 33, that there's a lot that can come out of it that is rich and not just because of, or in spite of, but you know, because of what you have gone through. And Lucy and Liza have talked about that. Like, I wouldn't know these women if I hadn't been through what I've been through. And I'm so grateful for that. So the modern, of course, you know, alludes to the type of person reading it, but also their age, but also, you know, of course, this day and age of technology, of interconnectedness, of, you know, always being able to be bothered and reached, which brings its pros and cons. And also just really the attitude. I mean, are you willing to approach the topic of loss in a way that is kind of no holds barred, that is really conversational, that can have some levity to it? Because grief is actually pretty funny, because sometimes what more do you have than the ability to laugh? I mean, if you can choose between going insane and laughing, I personally would like always specifically choose the latter. But, you know, the modernist really alludes to a lot of it, so I'm going to take her out for a hot chocolate and we're going to have a conversation. But this piece is from, it's an intro to our chapter called Data, Loss and Found in the Digital Universe. And I really love this essay of mine. It's not as flowery as Lucy's and Liza's, so I apologize for that, but I think that it's quite relatable. I was futzing around online at work one Friday afternoon when an email popped into my Outlook stream. I'm coming up with baked chicken tonight, my mom wrote. Hang in there. I love you. Well, that sounded pretty fantastic to me. For starters, it had been a pretty rough week. Also, I was hungry. And finally, I really missed my mom's apricot chicken, considering she'd been dead for more than a year. Her email was dated May 15th, 2006, nearly 4 months before she died. That was around the same time I'd been in the dumps after breaking up with my longtime boyfriend, conveniently right smack in the midst of wedding season amongst my friends. Gazing at the loving words on my screen, my visceral reaction was to allow myself to be tricked into the possibility that I was actually going to see her that evening. But that was short-lived. There would be no home-cooked dinner, no hugs and kisses and assurances that chances are we're good, I wouldn't end up like Miss Havisham. No mom. Just more Ollie's Chinese takeout and a handful of digital dust taunting me with happier memories. Never before had the internet played such a cruel trick on me. Not even when an early version of Pandora had inexplicably erased dozens of carefully crafted stations, such as Bloody Mother Fucking Asshole Radio, which is actually a song by Martha Wainwright. But oh, would the internet continue to do so? That email, which had bent time and space in its route toward my inbox, was my introduction to the wily nature of the web and its digital cousins, and to the massive wrench that technology has tossed into the grieving process. Since my parents died, I've had to be on guard against emotional digital sneak attacks. I've declined repeated notes from LinkedIn, insisting I really should consider connecting with Ray Rosenberg. Yes, that would be great to connect with my dead dad. Thanks. Or gotten fleetingly excited when a Google alert indicated new updates on my mom, Shelby Rosenberg, only to read a piece, weirdly, on a star male forward on the Yeshiva University basketball team. Or spent hours, who would have thought? Or spend hours on multiple devices deleting Mother's Day onslaughts from marketers ranging from the unsurprising, looking at you, edible arrangements, to the truly very much so, et tu, Jiffy Lube. And then I just want to jump to one last paragraph. My mom died about the time that Facebook started to take off. So I don't have the benefit of being able to sift through her posts whenever I like it, feel like it, smiling at what would have surely been many social justice awareness campaigns and inadvertent Candy Crush invites. But I found other places to visit her on Facebook. My favorite is Growing Up Jewish in Northeast Philly, a closed group of more than 6,000 enthusiastic members, of which I am one, even though I did not, in fact, grow up Jewish in Northeast Philly. This group has become an unwitting support system to me and a touchstone to her. Do I remember lunches at Jack's Deli, hanging out at the American Bandstand Studios after school, or shopping at Kaplan's for Buster Brown's? Nope. But it's comforting to think my mom probably did, because those seem like nice memories to have.
Thank you. Well, I'm interested, Lucy, you mentioned this unexpected connection with this person in the Isle of Skye, and I myself have had lots of experiences of people connecting through the internet, and it is also... it's also somewhat surreal, and I'm old enough that my loss was before there were lots of chat rooms and sort of ways to get in touch with people about your very specific situation. And I'm wondering if you guys have looked into that and found it useful or found it actually deadening or some of both.
I'm in a Facebook group called Hot Young Widows Club, and it's amazing. It was founded by Nora McInerney, who is a genius, and in case you know anybody who needs to be in it, they can Google it and get into it on Facebook, and I have found it incredibly helpful. It's super real. People talk about all kinds of things from, you know, how to write a eulogy to feeling angry at other people at the PTA meeting who have a spouse, to throwing a fit at the Verizon store when they're turning in their late husband's cell phone, and the, you know, feeling ashamed later that they did that. And it's just neat. I found it really helpful in connecting, and I think especially for communities like grief, where either it may not be that there are a lot of people around you going through the same thing, or you just haven't found the right niche for that, I think that is particularly helpful. And also the idea, you know, with an online group too, sometimes you just want to visit, and sometimes you contribute, and I think that's right. Kind of a really nice thing too. Mm-hmm.
I wish there was a Facebook group for hot young mothers who have lost mothers who are taking care of children, but not really taking care of the children.
Make it right now.
There isn't. Maybe after this panel. But, you know, what was sort of unexpected, we sort of had an almost reverse experience when Raina passed. We live in a small neighborhood, and all of a sudden it really showed up as the neighborhood it is. So, you know, this was one of the unexpected and I think kind of taboo things about death, is that you suddenly are connected. You know, I felt such a surge of warmth and love, and I have to say it was pretty greedily drinking it in, not just because I was grieving, but because we tend to be more disconnected as people, and all of a sudden all of these barriers fell down around people at school, about teachers, and that really didn't need to be there in the first place. So, no, I didn't find comfort in technology. I certainly would have if there had been something, but I did find sort of an unexpected falling back to the way things might have been for many years.
Thank you.
Oh, I was just going to add that, like, obviously I found comfort in technology. I mean, I run a site called Modern Loss, so that's been very comforting to see how many people have contributed to it. And not only that, but, like, we have a Facebook group of thousands and thousands, just like Hot Young Widows Club, but it's broader. We have an open Facebook group, and we have a closed Facebook group where people on any given day, like I can lurk or I can comment, and people just, I just looked today, and a woman just started a job in D.C. She just moved from New York, and she was saying, okay, I'm at my new job. My mom's been dead for a year. How do I handle this when my managers ask me about my family? And yeah, like that's like a sticky wicket kind of situation. And these groups can be so incredibly helpful because you have a variety of people who are offering advice and warmth or just, you know, camaraderie and venting with you. And it's just incredibly powerful. I do think that there's a flip side. And I think it's just the flip side that is that we deal with, you know, in every aspect of online culture right now, is that there's a dark underbelly, and we haven't kind of fully mastered how to integrate our online persona with our in-person persona. Sorry, that's like redundant, but I'm tired. but I think that, you know, at Modern Loss, we try and promote technology and like these platforms like TimeHop or like, you know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook groups as a way to encourage people to share their personal narratives on loss, because it kind of forces other people to bear witness to your loss, and we think that that can only help open up the conversation, because if you aren't really dealing with loss directly, you know, the joke is on you, because like you will at some point one day. And so our hope is that we can just make the world at large more empathic and make more people feel comfortable talking about it and reading about it, so that when they go through it, they don't feel as isolated as we did in a way. But I do think that there is a tendency for online reaction to like just kind of like something or, you know, comment like with like the heart or like prayers, you know. And that's really great, because I think you can get immediate comfort when you seek that out, but it only goes so far. I think sometimes it's like, you know, downing a packet of sugar. You're going to feel amazing and super energized for a very finite period of time, but then you're going to crash and you're just going to not feel so great. I think that that's what those kind of one-off shows of support can do. And so what I personally hope is that we can figure out a way to harness technology as a trigger for more meaningful action beyond just the like or the one comment or like the, you know, thinking of you, like sending hearts. And I think we can get there. I just think we have to keep at it.
I think Rebecca's book and site are really interesting, because I think you also talk about how, just as relationships are complicated and messy, a relationship with someone in grief can be as well. Like there's an essay by somebody who's finds out later that her husband was unfaithful. And then there's another one by a mother whose child dies of an opioid overdose, who then starts a boxing gym for other people whose children have died of opioid overdoses. And it just is like really rich and complicated and sort of human in the way that everything is, but through the lens of grief. So it's sort of really fascinating and true and real.
Thank you. We could talk for quite a long time, but I wanted to leave a little bit of time for your questions. So we have about 10 minutes left, and I'm wondering if anyone would like to ask a question. You can take a minute, because I know this topic is hard to put your hand up about. Or you might even be able to just talk from, just, great.
Did you hear the other part or so? And my question for Lucy and for anybody who's been involved in loss and the person who is dying specifically is in the hospital. My experience has been that doctors see loss and death specifically a lot of times as a failure, as a professional failure and a giving up a giving up and saying, this is going to happen. How can we make this time life instead of just a medical sprint? And I'm wondering if you've seen any change, or if you know, I didn't, or if you know of any way that culture can change.
Yeah, so I think this is a big thing in medical culture. For people who didn't hear it, she's a hospital chaplain and has worked in palliative care. So the prominent metaphor in illness, especially cancer, but many illnesses, of the battle, you know, and you fight this valiant battle and you succumb or you lose the fight, or it's like it's very black and white, and you know, we live inside fragile, mortal bodies, and the culture within medicine is, there really is this culture, or there has been, about having your patient die is a failure. And that, I think, is starting to change in a real way. And I think the growth of palliative care as a specialty, and just for people who don't know, palliative care is a medical specialty focused on quality of life. Hospice, which is for people who have a terminal illness, is a tiny piece of palliative care. And then palliative care is for anybody who has a serious illness that's causing them either existential or physical or social, spiritual distress, like Parkinson's or emphysema or whatever it might be. And anyway, they're a medical team that supports people through serious illness. But I think the growth of that field alongside traditional medical care, and then even I think, the taboos that are outside the hospital follow people into the hospital too, about not talking about these things. And doctors used to really not be trained necessarily to talk about these things. And now medical school includes role playing to talk about, you know, quality of life in a serious illness or delivering bad news. And I think Paul's book, I think, is following in the wake of Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal. There are a number of memoirs about loss and mortality. And I think the public demand for thinking about these topics and talking about them and exploring them is influencing medical culture as well. So I do see that changing. And I also think, whether you are within the dyad of a physician-patient or physician-provider relationship, I think patients also can be driving that culture change too, just by asking questions in a way that indicates a full, a desire to enter into all aspects of thinking about an illness and not just the one battle metaphor. But it's not easy.
I was just going to add that I think Paul's book specifically, I think, is helping change that culture somewhat. It's being taught in med schools, people are reading it, and there are these just terrific conversations between him and his doctor. They have a long relationship, and she talks, he keeps asking, well, how long do I have? And she says, I'm not answering that question. I want to think about what you're going to do with that time and what we can do to help you live the way you want to live during that time. And that whole, that framework and that approach, I think, is very instructive for young doctors to hear. So I was happy about that. Other questions?
If you have any questions, can you come up to the front?
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I really wanted to be here to say hello and thank you for what you're doing, because many people have been through this experience themselves and have not had the opportunity to really think about it in different ways, which you provide a good perspective. I want to make a little comment and then ask a question. All right. Okay. I am a survivor of one brain surgery, two bouts with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and through this I have had to face my own mortality, deal with questions of hospice, palliative care, what I want to have happen after, and my doctor has been a wonderful person, but I also, in my own way, think I'm helping her, or have helped her, by saying, I'm okay with what happens to me because you have extended my life more than I would have had in the beginning. And I'm wondering, now that you all have been through this yourself, how you now feel about your own approach to your own mortality.
I'm not a speaker, but I'll say one thing, which is I feel, when my husband was dying, he said that he wasn't afraid, and I really thought he was lying, and it turned out he wasn't, and I feel less afraid, and I feel, I have kids, and I just appreciate my time with them, and I'm always thinking like, oh, they made it to 10 and 12 with me. I mean, I'm healthy, but I just, after having that experience, I know that things can happen. And I have a sense, I gained a great gift from that experience in terms of feeling like my mortality is very close to me all the time.
Mm-hmm. I feel like on the one hand, I'm not afraid to lose my life from a selfish standpoint, but I'm a lot more stressed about what kind of impact it could have on my kids, because they've talked about scattershot, stood by their best friends while their mom died. So in all honesty, I think it's become a little bit harder, and something that I still need to be working on is, this is an ongoing process, and I think it might come back to the whole thing about grief is, an evolution. It's not something that sort of peters out over time.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree. I would be lying if I said I wasn't afraid to die. I don't want to die. I don't feel like it. I have a lot of energy. I have a lot to be around, stick around for. I think we're going to have lunch after this, and I want to be around for all of that, so I'm hungry. But I just, you know, I would like to think that if I am in, you know, I have a specific goal because I've been very fortunate to meet these astounding human beings who are, you know, some of whom are sitting right next to me, some are out here in the audience, others are all around the world, and I would have never met them had I not gone through what I went through. And they have been so incredibly inspiring, and I think that what they have taught me and what I have learned from my own experience with loss is... I guess, you know, yes, I don't want to think about dying. I think about it every day. I think about it in ways that I think are more subtle. And I think it comes through in how I live my life with my kids. I lost kind of the most primal bond that you can have with a human being, which is, you know, mother, child, father, child, that vanished from one second to the next two times over. And I never thought I was going to have it again. To feel like you can't, there's nothing before you and nothing after you is just the most surreal feeling. It feels like just an out of body experience. And so I never really even thought, I went through a very dark time and I really didn't think I was going to be around at some point. You know, there were moments where I didn't know if I was going to make it emotionally. After losing my mom and then my dad, I didn't know if I was going to make it. I didn't know that there would be years down the line when I'd be sitting here on a panel, you know, talking about loss. I would have laughed because it would have seemed so ludicrous. And so here I am indeed several years down the line, and I am on a panel about writing through loss. And I do have children, and I didn't think I was going to have them. I thought I was too damaged to even partner with somebody who would even want to procreate with me. So I guess I fooled him really well, because now I have two kids and an amazing husband. And the time that I spend with them is, you know, there's part of me that like just wants to stay at home with them every second of the day, because I just want to be around for everything. I'm just so aware of the, you know, just the few, it can just vanish from one second to the next. I saw my mom and then I got a phone call and that was it. I was wearing the same clothes from when I gave her a hug to when I heard my dad screaming on the other side of the phone after there was an accident. And so part of me wants to be around them every single second, but the other part of me just wants to also really do meaningful work, which I feel like I have found and is so fulfilling. And so the time that I do spend with them, which is a lot of time, I feel like I am so much more present than I very well might have been had I not gone through what I went through, losing my parents. I'm quite sure of that. I mean, I'm a very energetic person. I have like a functional level of, you know, necessary anxiety for being able to live in New York City. And, you know, I don't know if I might have been a little bit more distracted or whatnot. But I sit and I like try and absorb every single moment of, you know, my kids' development and of like the stories they tell and asking them stories. I mean, like Lucy was just telling these anecdotes about Katie and like she's hysterical. I love her, and like I just love watching my kids as they do like really cool and weird things that I'm not smart enough to be doing. And again, like I just think it's such a gift. It is. And you know, I think we play this game with ourselves. It's like, oh, like, but I'd give it all back if I could just have my parents back, or if I could have my husband back or my friend back. You know, I'd give this. Well, you know, I think it's a losing battle, because it kind of is what it is. And for me, that's been my most powerful mantra. And so whenever I find myself in that space of, you know, wishing that it wasn't what it was, you know, I eventually come back to that mantra, and then it just makes me weirdly very, very, very grateful. And so in terms of my mortality, I think I'm scared to die, but I am enjoying life so much.
I feel similarly. I think even apart from mortality, I think a lot about transience or impermanence and how, you know, within the span of a life, we live all these different lives that come and then go. you know, like right now I'm the mother to a young child, and I wasn't that before, and I won't be that again. And so I sort of feel similarly to you, Rebecca, where it's sort of like, and even in the span of human history, you know, it's like we're each alive for, you know, whatever amount of time, maybe 90 years, and that's tiny, tiny, tiny in the arc of everything, and it's like, this is our moment. We're in our moment right now. So I think about that, too.
And that is a great place to stop. It is 1 o'clock, so we'll stop our panel. Thank you so much, the three of you, for coming.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.